From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Whenever the United States is engaged in hostilities abroad, the media are at war too, with the Pentagon, as they battle to extract more information from a Defense Department institutionally predisposed to provide less.
A reasonable analogy for war correspondents would be sports reporters. On one hand, their intense coverage of a team's players and on-field triumphs makes them a de facto marketing arm of the teams they cover. On the other hand, their inevitable hard questions and criticism are greeted with fear and suspicion by the very same organizations.
Think of the build-up and early days of a war as baseball in the spring, when reporters uncritically supply puffy profiles and the PR line. But at some point, when the losses start piling up, tension between the press and those they cover rapidly develops.
Only 3 weeks into the war in Afghanistan, the confrontation between the military and the media is already mounting. Despite repeated admonitions from the government that the war could last years, editorials have begun to ask for an end game, an exit strategy, and the defeat of the Taliban before the rapidly approaching Muslim holy period of Ramadan. The gee whiz reports from the decks of aircraft carriers are still there, but so is the second guessing. Here's a representative sample from a briefing this week with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes, go ahead.
We've heard from this podium maybe a week and a half ago, the Taliban was eviscerated, that their communications were nearly cut off or almost there. Now we're hearing that they're dogged. Can you just give us some perspective? Is this just the nature of the conflict, or did the military miscalculate what it would
take? Oh, look, we're trying to have daily briefings. There's been an enormous appetite for daily briefings. And when I get up in the morning, I say, by golly, we're going to feed that appetite.
Leaks of operational details have infuriated an already media-skittish Secretary of Defense. In an environment of suspicion and increasing defensiveness, how are the media supposed to get anything from the military? They read between the lines, say reporters like David Martin, longtime national security correspondent for CBS. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Now, we've been seeing almost daily briefings from the Pentagon. How many of your stories do you get from press conferences? And if not the press room, where do you get them?
The news is often not in those briefings. The news is often out in the hallways of the Pentagon. You have to understand that the Pentagon is a very, very open place. I have my building pass, and I can just about go any place I want in this building, and I've surprised more than one Secretary of Defense in the hallways over the years who had no idea that reporters had such free rein. And that's my basic M.O. in covering the Pentagon, is to roam the building.
So as you roam the hallways, how can you tell when something is up, when a story is breaking?
There's a body language that goes with this building. You suddenly, one day, start seeing people walking just a half step faster. You see them carrying little briefcases, which are labeled top secret and code word information. And you see people closing their doors.
Can you give me an example of when walking faster tipped you off that something was happening?
Well, to me, the clearest example happened on the day we invaded Panama back in 1989. Dick Cheney, who I think is probably the most self-contained person I've ever covered, was walking not a half step faster. He was walking 2 to 3 times his normal speed. And it's actually the only time I ever saw Dick Cheney look like he was in a hurry or under any kind of pressure.
And what about other nonverbal signals? For instance, a grunt or a nod or averting of eyes. Do you have to play the psychiatrist when getting some of this information?
In a sense, you do. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that people walk around here with a bunch of facial tics communicating in code. But if somebody doesn't want to tell you that the first of the 75th Rangers is going to jump into Kandahar Airfield in southern Afghanistan tonight, they might say something to you like, who leads the way? Well, if you've been around the military enough, you know that who leads the way is part of the Ranger slogan. The line goes, who leads the way? Rangers lead the way.
So you're talking about a kind of code, not a military code, but a kind
right.
of this Pentagon cognoscenti code.
That's a very good way of putting it, yes.
Is there anybody who's currently around the Pentagon who is particularly easy to read?
Currently, no, unfortunately for me.
What about Colin Powell?
Well, Colin Powell, I thought, was always very easy to read. If something was up, he'd usually bark at you. He'd say something like, get out of my AO, Martin. And AO is military speak for area of operations.
Now, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld has been very vocal about leaks to the media. He issued another warning to government employees this week. Are his warnings having any impact? Do you find that people are shrugging, grunting, nodding, talking less?
Well, they're certainly talking less. I think he's basically driving them to the shrug and the nod way of communicating, because he clearly is on the warpath about leaks, and that has a chilling effect.
Is it true that sometimes after a leak, everyone there is required to do a polygraph test?
They do give polygraph tests on certain programs. I'm told that there's a polygraph investigation going on now into who leaked the story of the fact that the U.S. had a Predator unmanned reconnaissance drone circling over Afghanistan armed with a missile that it would have used to kill either Mullah Omar or Osama bin Laden if they had had the chance.
Do you think that a leak like that threatens national security?
I can see their point on that one, because obviously you have a better chance of getting bin Laden or Mullah Omar if they have absolutely no idea that such a capability exists.
So you wouldn't have reported about the drone?
Ooh, don't ask me that. That's a tough one.
Well, David Martin, I don't want to keep you. You have 17 and a half miles of Pentagon corridor to walk. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Okay.
David Martin is the national security correspondent for CBS News.
One big frustration for reporters is to have access to a certain category of detailed information only to have it suddenly snatched away. This occurred recently in the matter of satellite photographs. Until now, a commercial imaging satellite called Iconos had been available for the media and any other paying customer wishing to examine detailed pictures of the Afghan landscape. In an unusual move, however, the U.S. government has preempted them by purchasing for millions of dollars all Iconos images of the region. The Pentagon did not invoke so-called shutter control, which permits it, for national security reasons, to restrict commercial use of a satellite. But the effect is the same, leading some critics to assume the military is trying to cover up its actions in the war zone. Joining us now is John Pike, founder of GlobalSecurity.com, a nonprofit group that, among other things, helps media analyze satellite images. John, welcome to OTM.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with some technical stuff, please. The Iconos satellite we're talking about has resolution to about 1 meter, which means...
It basically means that you might barely be able to detect a person. You're certainly not going to be able to identify a person. But compared to the previous commercial satellites, you can certainly see and identify airplanes, whereas previously all you could see would be the airport or the runway.
All right. Now, what about the government intelligence satellites? There are at least six of those. How much detail can they detect?
Well, the government satellites are a lot more expensive than the commercial satellites, and they're vastly better. The classified systems can easily tell the make and model of a car, can easily spot an individual human being, although even those systems aren't good enough to identify a human being.
Okay, so for the purposes of the war in Afghanistan, with these intelligence satellites beaming back such refined images, does the U.S. government really need Iconos?
So I think that the strategy of the U.S. government is to take the high-resolution military satellites, have them focused on the highest priority targets, and then to use the commercial satellite imagery to focus on the lowest priority targets, where that 1 meter resolution is basically adequate to tell you that, yes, the desert is indeed still empty and that there are no cars or pickup trucks out there.
Okay, but another reason for preemptively obtaining the images would be to keep them out of other people's hands. If the government has them, then the media and certainly the enemy don't have them. Do you suppose there's an element of that going on here too?
Well, Washington is a big town, and nothing ever happens in this town for just one reason, and I have no doubt that one of the additional benefits of the exclusive licensing policy is that it's making it more difficult for other users to obtain commercial imagery of Afghanistan.
When the Clinton administration opened up the commercial spy satellite business, it included this provision that essentially permitted censorship during wartime. But instead, the government decided to spend all this money and buy the information. Why didn't they just invoke the shutter control privilege?
The real problem that the U.S. government and the Defense Department would have, I think, is demonstrating why the restrictions that were being placed on the satellite imagery were reasonable and did not go beyond the restrictions that were being placed on other forms of news gathering. Unavoidably, news organizations would view this as being prior restraint. They would ask, why is it that we can photograph Bagram Air Base with our cameras on the ground, but you're not going to allow us to get a satellite image of exactly the same location? And obviously the government isn't going to want to lose that case.
There was a story in the Guardian newspaper in the United Kingdom suggesting that the government, by purchasing not only new images from Iconos, but images dating back to the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, they were able to cover up damage to civilian facilities and widespread death of civilians. Is it possible this is just big cover-up?
Well, I think that the Defense Department is obviously interested in controlling the information that's coming out about this war. The Bush administration came into office wanting to tighten up on information policy, and this has been by far the most secretive war that the United States has fought over the last decade. I don't think that the primary reason for the government's purchase of the Iconos imagery is controlling the flow of information, but unavoidably you have to conclude that it does have that additional benefit, that you've basically removed the possibility of independent monitoring, independent verification of what's going on inside Afghanistan, and made it extraordinarily difficult to independently evaluate the claims one way or the other about civilian casualties or refugees inside Afghanistan.
Very well. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Pike is director of GlobalSecurity.org, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that examines satellite images.
Coming up, some news that does not involve the war on terrorism, election coverage across the country, including Hollywood's cutthroat campaign.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. These days, a careful news consumer can, as always, search the newspaper, the airwaves, and the internet for most of what he needs to know. But the rest of us scan the headlines for what's important, and lately most of what comes through is news about Afghanistan and anthrax. To be sure, this is a season of crisis, but it's also a time for the conduct of ordinary democracy. And among the stories pushed off the nation's front pages are those involving local elections, and specifically contests for mayor. So we asked a few reporters to bring us up to date on the coverage of some representative races from WDET in Detroit, WCPN in Cleveland, and WBUR in Boston. Let's start in Boston.
The outcome of the mayor's race here is usually a foregone conclusion, given that an incumbent hasn't been defeated in 50 years. But this year, the campaign is a little different. Boston City Councilor Peggy Davis Mullen mounted an uphill challenge to two-term Mayor Tom Menino because she said she wanted to talk about education and affordable housing. But despite the challenge, the media still didn't cover the campaign aggressively, says University of Massachusetts political analyst Lou DiNatale.
In order for newspapers and media outlets to aggressively and daily cover politics, the race has to seem to be competitive, and there has to seem to be something serious at stake, like winning.
But the Boston mayoral race never seemed close, and there was another campaign competing for attention, one to win a special election to fill a vacant congressional seat. DiNatale says the mayor's race never had a chance.
It got overshadowed almost immediately by the special election for Congress, and then it got buried by the events of September 11th.
There has been only one televised debate. It aired after September 11th in what one columnist called the antithesis of primetime on Saturday night. For On the Media, I'm Tony Randolph in Boston.
This is Prima Oza from member station WDET in Detroit. Media coverage of the Detroit mayoral race has been overshadowed in the wake of last month's terrorist attacks. Government officials and local media instead have focused on anthrax scares and on bomb threats at the city's two Canadian border crossings. With Election Day rapidly approaching, the campaigns of candidates Gil Hill and Kwame Kilpatrick are running ugly and often inaccurate attack ads in an effort to pry Detroit voters away from CNN. But many public opinion experts argue that the ads ran too soon for a city still reeling in the aftermath of September 11th. Dr. Victoria Menzopoulos is a professor of political science at the University of Detroit Mercy.
I expected that the public wasn't ready for negativism yet. A kinder, gentler nation in some ways as we pull together to try to heal ourselves.
Yet it appears that it's negativism that makes Detroiters sit up and take notice. Detroit political analyst Mario Moro.
Nobody is willing to discuss the issue. However, if you get your name out there, if you kill your candidate off, then people might like you.
Moro says the city's usual campaign issues, such as crime, abandoned building demolition, and inadequate city lighting, have taken a back seat, not only to terrorism, but to a $30 million budget shortfall, announced recently by the current mayor, Dennis Archer. For On the Media, this is Prima Oza in Detroit.
I'm Janet Babin in Cleveland. Here, when the campaign for mayor began, voters had 10 choices. Campaign officials say it was difficult for the media to cover such a large group, but after the terrorist attacks, stories about the mayor's race became even scarcer. Candidates running TV spots pulled them, and all formal campaigning went dark for a week. Strategists predicted a low turnout in the primary, but local elections director Tom Gillespie says the attacks had the opposite effect.
The patriotism that people are feeling now over the tragedies that have occurred in the country, you know, got people out.
40% of the voters elected two candidates who face off next month. Former state representative Jane Campbell could become the city's first woman mayor. Political newcomer Raymond Pierce's most recent job was in Washington in the Department of Education under President Clinton. Even as Election Day nears, journalist Ted Gupp says coverage of the candidates has been dramatically reduced.
Everything has understandably taken a back seat, and crisis has eclipsed mayoral campaigns and all the other stories that are the meat and potatoes of metropolitan newspapers.
Candidates Campbell and Pierce agree they have to answer questions voters weren't asking a few months ago. So they're talking less about traditional campaign issues like crime and education, instead pointing out their courage and strong leadership skills to appease what they see as a nervous electorate. For On the Media, I'm Janet Babin in Cleveland.
And joining us now is Newsday columnist and general man about New York City, Ellis Hennigan. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Brooke. Good to be here.
So how about the mayoral race in New York? Is it getting the accustomed amount of coverage or something less than that?
We're having a mayor's race in New York? It has been vastly undercovered compared to a typical run for mayor in New York. You know, these kind of stories tend to dominate the papers in this town for weeks and months at a time. Here we had some stories in the paper. I don't want to say we ignored it, but nowhere near a normal year for local political coverage.
And, you know, it's surprising because this wasn't even a normal mayoral race. We had a runoff, which is extremely unusual. We have the soon-to-be-displaced new mayor to the world, New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, finally moving off the plate. All of these things should probably be big news.
No, we had all the elements, right? You know, there was drama. There was a question of New York after Giuliani. In another year, we could have milked this thing to death. This year, we just never really got around to it.
And the reason is obvious, right? September 11th.
Well, you should have sat in the 3:30 news meeting at Newsday on any one of dozens of days, you know. But I mean, it wasn't only us. The candidates themselves shut down for weeks at a time. You know, they were very, very uncomfortable, all the campaigns, right after September 11th. You know, we were 3 or 4 hours into the voting on the initial primary vote when this attack occurred. And so the campaigns were all extremely nervous about starting again. They didn't want to be accused of being the grubby politico at a time of such difficulty in the city.
Is November 6th going to be the election day that hardly was?
Well, to me, one of the cheery things about the past couple of weeks is that the candidates really started beating up on each other again, like New York politicians are supposed to. I know there were people around town who were saying, oh, this is so terrible and we should be elevated beyond that in this new era. Give me a break. To me, that was the equivalent of going out on the town again, spending money, New York coming alive. If these guys aren't swinging baseball bats at each other's heads, there's something wrong with us.
Have there been other stories pushed off the front pages at Newsday?
I'll tell you what the tendency is, and it's been true as I've written columns in the past month, and it's been true as we've laid out the front page. It's not that we don't do those other stories, but any time I write about a subject that isn't exactly a terror story, somehow or another, my tendency is to connect it into the thing that all New Yorkers are talking about, which is that overriding sense of insecurity that we now feel in this town. So even if I'm writing a Yankee column, somewhere in there is going to be a line that says something about now more than ever, the symbolism of the Yankees at a time like this. Whatever it is, go out to eat, go see a play, hop into the sack with the one you love, now more than ever.
Ellis, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke. That was fun.
Ellis Hennigan writes a column for Newsday.
Election results for president of the Screen Actors Guild are expected to be announced this week, and we'll be hearing more on that shortly. But if history is any guide, the candidates may be auditioning for another role, U.S. politics. Song and dance man George Murphy used the SAG presidency as a stepping stone to the U.S. Senate in 1964. His successor as Guild president, Ronald Reagan, also had some success in politics, and the two shared something else. They were both Republicans. Though the acting community is notoriously Democratic, most of the actors elected to public office have come out of GOP studios. According to On the Media's John Solomon, this is more than just a coincidence.
California State Senator Sheila Kuehl is one of the nation's few openly lesbian elected officials, but she is a member of an even rarer political minority group, former actors who have been voted to office as Democrats. Kuehl, who played Zelda Gilroy on the early 60s TV series The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, is only the third such Democrat elected in modern American history. Previously, theater actress Helen Gehagen Douglas was sent to Congress from Los Angeles in 1944. Ben Jones, Cooter on The Dukes of Hazzard, represented a suburban Atlanta district in the U.S. House from 1988 to 1992. But beginning with George Murphy and Ronald Reagan, the Republican Party has fielded a larger cast of elected performers. In 1986, Fred Grandy went from the Love Boat to Congress. Sonny Bono joined him there in 1994. Clint Eastwood successfully ran for mayor of Carmel, California. And movie actor Fred Thompson currently represents Tennessee in the U.S. Senate. Sheila Kuehl suggests one reason for the Republican advantage is that Democratic actors need to build a political resume before party leaders and voters feel they are qualified for office.
Whereas many Republican candidates who get elected can be more personalities or simply anti-government. And sometimes a lack of experience is considered a plus in a Republican campaign. One is thought to be, you know, fresh and unspoiled, as it were.
Geography is another explanation. According to Ron Brownstein, author of The Power and the Glitter, which examines the relationship between Hollywood and Washington, Democratic actors working and living in Los Angeles or New York often find their ambitions blocked by the lines of Democratic politicians also interested in running. And there are not many places in the middle of the country where a liberal Democratic actor can realistically win, because they can be tarred with Hollywood's Sodom and Gomorrah reputation. GOP actors don't have that problem. Ron Brownstein.
It may be a little easier for the Republicans than the Democrats to make the jump, and it's for a good Hollywood reason, in that it's playing against type. You are, in effect, insulated from the inevitable charge that you stand for a liberal institution that's corrupting American morals.
Also politically damaging to liberal celebrities is that activism on the coasts can make them appear more extremist in the heartland, even among moderate Democratic voters. That's according to the Dukes of Hazzard's Ben Jones, the only former actor elected as a Democrat outside of Los Angeles.
The nature of the issues around Screen Actors Guild politics and things like that sort of push these folks to the left, to not a moderate or centrist Democratic Party viewpoint, but on the left fringe. Warren Beatty and Barbara Streisand, people who are always talking about running for president and have high political profiles, couldn't get elected dog catcher in this neck of the woods in Virginia.
Most Democratic actors who have run recently have lost decisively. Ralph Waite, Pa in The Waltons, was soundly defeated by Sonny Bono. Actor Barry Gordon, also a former SAG president, lost a California congressional race in 1998. Nancy Culp, banker Jane Hathaway on the Beverly Hillbillies, tried unsuccessfully for Congress from Pennsylvania. It didn't help that co-star Buddy Ebsen campaigned for her GOP opponent. It is likely that the Republicans will continue to recruit in Hollywood. Democrats, on the other hand, have actively solicited celebrities' financial resources and public support, but the party has not made as much of an effort to sign them up as candidates. Sheila Kuehl.
It would be a useful thing for the party to think seriously about who might be a good candidate and begin to speak to them.
Kuehl nominates Tom Hanks and Martin Sheen as actors warranting special attention. Indeed, that could be the problem. It may be that politically active Democrats are having too much success to change careers. Veteran actor and former SAG president Richard Masser.
There has never been anybody who ran for office at the height of their career. Ronald Reagan's career was basically over when he went into politics.
So, maybe the key for Democrats looking to even the political score is to make sure Republican-leaning actors keep working. After Ronald Reagan became governor of California, movie director William Wyler remarked to a Democratic colleague, "If we had only given him a couple of good parts, he'd never be in Sacramento now." For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
Now, on that Screen Actors Guild election currently underway, many members believe SAG is at a crossroads where contract disputes, cost-cutting proposals, and internal conflicts divide the union. The two leading candidates are Valerie Harper, Broadway actress and former sitcom star of Rhoda fame, and Melissa Gilbert, best known for her years of playing Laura on the family drama Little House on the Prairie. In fact, despite the seriousness of the issues facing the Guild, it's hard for many observers not to think of this campaign as a race between Rhoda Morgenstern and Laura Ingalls. Clearly, that's the case for veteran political reporter Michelle Breyer, who has our report.
When the 98,000 members of the Screen Actors Guild cast their ballots in October for a new president, they'll be choosing more than a new leader. This election is shaping up to be a battle for the heart and soul of the union. And at least one candidate is making it clear that she intends to fight hard to win.
Lauren Claire! Lauren Claire!
Laura Ingalls seems an unlikely contender for high office at first glance. She's a country girl, Pa's favorite, and while education has always been a priority, she's often viewed as more of the stay-on-the-farm type than a stumper. Then again, she's managed to win endorsements from community leaders in her hometown, like Mrs. Olson.
And what with her natural poise and beauty, Walnut Grove would have a model representative.
Even so, it's going to take a lot more than pleasantries to beat the well-oiled political machine utilized by Rhoda, as illustrated by the slick campaign video released by her camp.
My name is Rhoda Morvester. I was born in the Bronx, New York, in December 1941. I've always felt responsible for World War II. The first thing I remember liking that liked me back was food. I had a bad puberty. It lasted 17 years.
Rhoda hasn't been afraid to voice her other faults, hoping voters will embrace her as the people's representative.
I'm not easy to live with. I'm overly sensitive. You look at me cross-eyed, I go to pieces. When I feel hurt, I do one of two things. I withdraw or attack. I'm boring. Or the fact that I have no experience whatsoever living with a man.
This sharply contrasts with outgoing SAG president Kit, who lived for years with Michael Knight as man and car. Laura Ingalls, on the other hand, has taken a different tact. Just as George W. Bush reached out to Dick Cheney to give his presidential bid a dose of experience, 11-year-old Laura has tapped doctor and Korean War veteran B.J. Honeycutt as her running mate. She's also promoting her homegrown values as the center of her campaign platform.
Freedom of the press, Pa says, is as important as all our other freedoms and should never be abused.
Indeed, as is the case with many American political contests, this campaign may come down to a fight between urban and middle America. Laura's prairie background and Rhoda's status as a divorcee may not resonate with everyone on Main Street.
Hi. Would you vote for Rhoda Morgenstern or Laura Ingalls for president?
Isn't George W. Bush president?
Screen Actors Guild, what a bunch of morons ever since Ronald Reagan messed them up.
So who are you for?
I'm for Rhoda. She's independent, and she's gotten much more stylish since she gave up those headscarves.
Well, I'd vote for Laura because, I had a crush on her, but she also beat up Nellie Olson, and she can handle those advertisers on that royalty thing.
At least one survey agrees that Laura Ingalls has the edge. That's the survey of daily television appearances by either candidate. Laura makes family viewing several times a day in many markets, while Rhoda is mostly found only in brief late-night cameos. Members of the Screen Actors Guild will decide who will be their next president in balloting during the last 3 weeks of October. The winner will be announced November 5th. For On the Media, I'm Michelle Breyer.
Coming up, notes on the world's press, a life-saving soap opera, and the cultural glue that holds us together.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Periodically on the program, we like to check in with Martin Walker, senior international correspondent of UPI International. He reads virtually every newspaper in Europe, and he joins us now. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Hello again.
Now, since we last spoke, anthrax cases and anthrax scares have dominated the U.S. media. How's all this been playing overseas?
Well, in England, the initial reports were a touch mocking. There was a sense of, oh, the Americans are starting to panic. But then this was swiftly overtaken, as it was throughout the rest of Europe, by an absolute rash of anthrax scares all across Europe. The House of Commons was cleared for an hour while checks were made there after a report of some dubious white powder. There's been reports of and scares about anthrax in Paris, in Madrid, in Italy, in Germany, in Denmark. It's been fed, incidentally, by a rather unfortunate marketing decision by the French ski resorts to send out their catalogues to customers for this year, and they contained artificial snow or white powder.
And these were all scares. There weren't any actual incidences of anthrax, right?
No, unlike the USA, it's all really been scares, except that in Spain, of course, where anthrax is endemic, or animal anthrax, the mood there has been rather different. They began by saying, well, we have anthrax, we know about anthrax, but of course that was the anthrax that was quite specifically the version that's simply cutaneous and hits the skin. The way it's being reported in Belgium's Le Soir yesterday was that the death toll is raging in both places. They're dying in Afghanistan and they're dying in Washington.
The deaths in Washington seem to be exaggerated compared to those in Afghanistan.
Very much so, and I think this was simply a newspaper's way of trying to conflate the true stories, because there is growing concern around Europe about the effect upon civilian casualties and the way in which what was already a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan is now being made very much more serious. In France, Libération is saying today, the Gulf War and the airstrikes against Serbia taught us that civilians are killed in such operations, and this will come back like a boomerang.
I find it interesting that the European press seems to conflate the bombing campaign and the anthrax here, although President Bush tends to associate the anthrax with foreign terrorists. There's been a lot of rumblings in the press that perhaps this was a homegrown terrorism showing its face. Does anybody mull over that possibility in the European press?
Yes. In Denmark, the newspaper Information was saying that we simply don't know the origin of the anthrax. We don't know if it was weapons grade, if it was manufactured in some dark state dungeon of some dreadful malevolent power. They say the point is that it doesn't really matter. The three envelopes of anthrax spores have simply moved the focus back again. No more was needed. We're now aware of the very real greater dangers of biowarfare. I think I also detect among the Europeans a growing sense of unease that what ought to be an international coalition is looking more and more like a purely Anglo-Saxon one. The French paper Le Monde was noting at the end of last week, so much for NATO, it looks like the Anglo-Saxons are going to war alone again. And after all, the various offers of military assistance to President Bush from the French, from the Germans, and from the Italians and Spaniards have been politely turned down for the moment.
And so the united front that we seem to be perceiving at the beginning of all of this has already begun to crumble in places.
Well, indeed, Le Temps of Switzerland has been warning that the military action had better get a move on. I quote, if successes don't come quickly and bin Laden is allowed to thumb his nose at his enemies, the risk of the Muslim world seeing him as a hero and martyr increases. There is no doubt that some of the regimes currently allied to the West could collapse if the conflict is drawn out.
What about what the military calls collateral damage, that is, the civilians? And we don't know how many there are who have been killed during the recent bombing missions. Is this seen as the unavoidable cost of defeating al-Qaeda, or is it cause for serious dissension and concern?
It's becoming a problem. I noted that Germany's Handelsblatt, which is their financial paper, their sort of Wall Street journal, is noting rather glumly that, I quote, President Bush is reacting with the old reflexes of a superpower. Destruction alone will not bring Washington long-term stability in the region. And they're saying that it's time for a kind of a Marshall Plan for Asia under UN auspices.
Martin, astoundingly thorough as usual. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is the Chief International Correspondent for UPI International. That theme, familiar to anyone who's lived in Britain at any time over the last 50 years, belongs to The Archers, the longest-running radio drama in history. The BBC's idea was to instruct its rural listeners in the methods of modern farming, dressing up the lessons with the soap opera staples of romance and gossip. In 1994, the BBC set its didactic sights on a more remote agricultural community, Afghanistan. $35 million, that's 70% of the population, tune into each 15-minute episode of New Home, New Life. The lives of the characters who inhabit the fictional villages of the series are inextricably woven into the daily routine of real village communities, so much so that when one character was killed off, a day of public mourning was declared. In a country where even music is banned, the BBC appears to have slipped through the cracks. Shirazuddin Siddiqui is the producer of the program in Peshawar, Pakistan. He says the original aims of the program have changed over the years.
The show was initially set up to help Afghans to reconstruct Afghanistan. We were expecting that Afghans will go back to their country from Pakistan and from Iran, and the major issue would be the reconstruction of the country. But unfortunately, as the civil war broke in 1992, that did not happen, and the focus of the soap opera changed slightly. It tried to help Afghans to live better and cope with the difficulties of the sort of everyday life.
Now, the program presents a number of, I guess, what are frankly artistic challenges. You have a 15-minute drama in which you're trying to impart some cultural messages and, more importantly, some plain instruction about health and how to protect it.
Absolutely. For instance, hygiene is one of the most difficult things for the drama because there is very little tension in it. And so in a house, we have two co-wives married to the same man. There are lots of problems, and hygiene is one of the issues there. One of these women do not really practice hygiene so much, and the other is so critical, and there is always tension in that family.
I read a sad and fascinating statistic that regular listeners to your program are statistically less likely to be killed by landmines. What else have listeners learned?
To give you a small anecdote, for instance, I was talking to an elderly farmer in Afghanistan, and he was telling me that he had learned to cultivate onions. And I said, "Who told you this?" He said, "Well, my uncle Nick Muhammad." And I said, "Is this Muhammad an agriculturalist or a community leader? Who is he?" He looked at me and gave me a very firm look and said, "Don't you listen to New Home, New Life?"
Experts looking at Afghanistan say one of the greatest problems is that too many people are responding to the fear of the campaign by pulling up stakes and wandering around, bringing greater risk upon themselves. Do you advise somehow in the program people to stay put?
Yes, we do. We have interviewed, for instance, women who have left Jalalabad and have come to Peshawar all the way. She's walked through several mountains, and by the time she arrived in Peshawar, she lost one child and another child was totally dehydrated. So these are the real examples upon which we are drawing our storylines.
Now, the show was on the air since 1994. That's 2 years longer than the Taliban have been in power in Afghanistan. They've banned what amounts to every possible source of entertainment in the country, right down to music. How did your program escape the knife?
Because we are talking about sort of 70 to 80% of the population listening to the show. And a lot of the Taliban soldiers are our ardent listeners. And they could not really enrage these foot soldiers by banning radio because they were listening to it every day and night.
Do you have music in your program?
Quite a lot. And ever since the music was stopped and banned in Afghanistan and the radios, local radios in Afghanistan stopped playing music, we actually increased it a little bit.
Do you think that a radio soap opera can really penetrate the restrictive society that the Taliban enforces and change people's lives?
New Home, New Life is the evident example of that. It has penetrated and it has actually crossed any boundary. It has cracked the restrictions, and it has found its way to people's homes.
Well, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Shirazuddin Siddiqui runs the program New Home, New Life, and he spoke to us from Peshawar, Pakistan.
In a place as large and as diverse as America, there's no single program that can qualify as a universally shared cultural experience. Certainly not this one. So in our time of crisis, common threads that unite us are not all that easy to find. On the Media's Sarah Fishko looks back to an earlier era for inspiration.
Since September 11th, I've found myself thinking about Dame Myra Hess. Myra Hess was a British pianist who became world famous as the organizer and performer of lunchtime concerts in London during the Blitz in World War II.
It started by wondering what to do.
Myra Hess recorded in 1962.
All the public buildings were closed, you know, concerts had stopped. Nothing was going on, and the blackout, you know, made it so difficult for people to get home.
Hess was concerned about the effect of a cultural blackout on Londoners. Not only concerts, but live theater and even movies had been virtually suspended in the city. And so, as bombers flew overhead, as air raid sirens blared, Myra Hess and various colleagues played and kept on playing. Every day they played, in London's Trafalgar Square, in the National Gallery, which had been emptied of all its art treasures due to the bombing.
The National Gallery was always crammed.
Pianist Michael Hamburg played as a guest artist in many of the lunchtime concerts. She was 19 years old at the time.
All sorts of people, soldiers on leave with gas masks slung around them, office workers sitting totally quiet, a lot of them on the floor, just to hear peerless music.
The lunchtime concerts ran uninterruptedly, amazingly, from October 1939 until April 1946, 5 days a week. 1,698 concerts in all, heard by more than 800,000 people.
It was lovely because we were wanted and people felt we'd come to give them some kind of message which they might not know what it was, but which they felt was lacking in their daily life. It was a part of London life during the war which was extremely significant.
In fact, many said at the time, and since, that Myra Hess and her daily concerts were part of the glue that held the British together in wartime. Cultural glue. We're learning about its importance here in America, and it's maybe a little harder for us to find, but where we seem to be looking for it is on television. Not that we haven't looked there before.
It seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This summer's almost certain standoff.
We looked to one particular avuncular news anchor in times of crisis years ago.
And for every means we have to escalate, the enemy can match us. And that applies to invasion of the North.
But it's different now.
The three-network system is long gone. We're fragmented.
Terrence Moran is a professor of media and culture at New York University.
We can't have Kate Smith singing God Bless America and having most of the Americans tuned in for that on Saturday night. We used to say television was uniting the United States. Well, television is fragmented now, and the Internet has further fragmented us, and cable and satellites have fragmented us even further. So there really is no sort of core.
Unless you count late-night TV. It feels almost as if late-night has become our lunchtime.
Welcome to the Late Show.
The cultural routine.
On the air since New York and Washington.
The everydayness that we long to be back to.
Good evening, and welcome to The Daily Show.
And we are back to
it. Thank you very much. Welcome to The Tonight Show. Nice to have you all here.
Trying to laugh at what we fear the most.
Well, did you see those three Taliban leaders on the news announcing they have Osama bin Laden under control? All three of these guys have beards.
They hate America.
Why?
Well,
they don't get cable. What's the problem?
Lately, we've seen roles reversed and reversed again.
Here is Dan Rather. Dan, come on up.
We've seen anchormen cry.
If they could go down to ground zero and see the following, see those firemen? Take this for a minute, will you?
And politicians tell jokes.
Do you know what Osama bin Laden is going to be for Halloween? Dead.
Oh, dead.
Dead.
And funny men get very serious.
You can feel it. You can feel it. You can see it. It's terribly sad. Terribly, terribly sad. And watching all of this, I wasn't sure that I should be doing a television show because...
We've seen it all on late-night TV in the past weeks, after our long, anxious days. We'd already seen the power of late-night start to grow last fall during the presidential election.
It was the first time I can remember that comics were accorded political power.
Cecilia Tichy is the author of Electronic Hearth, Creating an American Television Culture.
It wasn't only the pundits, the so-called chattering classes, but that these guys cracking jokes were having an influence on the polls, on voters' disposition. So I think that, in a way, set us up for this moment when, in crisis, these folks come on and take on a new role vis-a-vis themselves and the public, and that role is to help further public education and, yes, to provide assurance.
What seems odd is that it is the same box, that same screen, that provides us with the cause and the cure. It is TV, almost like a sixth sense. Terrence Moran.
Marshall McLuhan famously said that media are extensions of ourselves. They're extensions of our senses and extensions of our nervous system. They're the ways in which we take in the information we need to survive.
TV is giving us the messages that help us feel our national coherence in a way that no space in our country can really do at this time.
Really tense. I've been backstage at a lot of rock concerts. I have never seen musicians run away from white powder. I'm telling you.
In our time, it seems to be a TV smirk, a curled lip in late night that tells us it's going to be okay. And that may be the closest thing we've got to the stiff upper lip of some inspirational Londoners who simply showed up at lunchtime a long time ago. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fischko.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Dylan Keefe, George Edwards, and Steve Sciarto, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Michael Cavanaugh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And when you do, tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And by process of elimination, that would make me Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.